There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Got a very special Coolest Conversations podcast today here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. My guest today is singer-songwriter, musician-producer Jack White. He's responsible for many cool songs over the course of his various music projects, from the White Stripes to the Rock on Tours. But we'll start off now by hearing some of a solo track of his, the song Over and Over and Over from 2018's Boarding House Reach. And then I'll be back with Jack White for your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Here in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's a big day on your Coolest Conversations, because on the line with me right now is singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and producer Jack White. How are you, Jack?
I'm doing good. How are you, Manfred?
Excellent. Excellent. Very happy to be chatting with you. Now, so my grandfather was one of 10 kids, 7 sisters, 3 brothers. You're one of 10. Is that right?
Yes, 7 brothers, 3 sisters. That's the flip. My mom was the same. She was the youngest of 7 daughters and 3 brothers. So it was a flip. I'm the 7th son of a 7th daughter.
Oh,
born
man.
Good luck.
Well, you almost hit that. So I would read you were a 7th son, and then I thought, well, you know, that ties in really cool with the whole mythos. But then I found out that to really get the mojo, you have to be the 7th son of a 7th son. Did you know that?
Right. And I'm the 7th son of a 7th daughter, so I'm very close, very close.
That is very close. In fact, I'm sure there's some kind of, like, earth magic that comes from that.
It must be.
So what is, like, the age range between you and your siblings?
That I'm way at the end. I'm 7 years after the 9th kid, and my mom was 45 when she had me, so I was way unexpected, way tagged on at the end. So it kind of has a lot to do with probably a lot of the things I'm interested in, because I basically grew up with nothing but older people around me. I mean, my oldest sister's 21 years older than me, so the age gap is gigantic, and everyone in my neighborhood by the time in Detroit in the 80s, you know, that it had been such a desolate place by that time that I was kind of hanging out with the people who liked Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan in my home, but walking in the street, everyone else was into the real Roxanne and LL Cool J and stuff. So, it was a big disparate thing going down in my neighborhood. So it was interesting to be kind of, raised by those kind of people of that age group, because I'd be super into Gene Krupa, for example, because my dad was in the 40s drummers. But, try talking to someone at school about that.
No. Did your sisters play a big part in raising you then?
Well, so yeah. Well, they always joke that they always were mistaken as for my mom when they would take me out. You know, say, tell your son he can have some ice cream or something, but they would. It's my brother.
So you're a Flatduo Jets fan, right?
Oh, yes, big time.
Right. So I bring that up because, like, Dexter Romweber, the guitar player in Flat Duo Jets, also from a very large family, at least seven in his case. And so he got into this early rock and roll and rockabilly things from the records of his older siblings. You know, there's later on there would be Sin Alley compilations, rockabilly compilations, but he actually got all those songs off the actual 45. So what influence did these older siblings have to do on your music development? You mentioned your dad and Gene Krupa, but what about like rock and roll kind of stuff? That was coming from
it
these...
It was kind of a two or three part thing for me, because growing up, my brothers and parents were really into music, and my brothers were musicians. You know, they played guitar, bass, and I was sort of the drummer in the family. Nobody else played drums. And I, so I was into all the stuff they were into. They were into a lot of things like, yeah, Johnny Cash, Bob Dylan, you know, classic rock and roll stuff, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, all of those things. And also Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and cool stuff like that. But they weren't that much into punk and things like that. Very. I don't know why that is, but it just wasn't their bag. But when I got to working at the upholstery shop when I was a teenager, I was working this guy, Brian Muldoon, and he started playing all these other things I had never heard before, the Cramps and the Velvet Underground and et cetera, et cetera. And we really got heavily into Flat Duo Jets at that time, along with all kinds of things. I was super into surf and just all kinds of 60s punk and garage rock. And I started kind of, besides all that, learning all those songs. And then, you know, learning songs, like I would learn a song like, you know, See the Pyramids Along the Nile. I'd learn that from Dexter Romweber from the Flat Duo Jets record, but then go back and listen to the original, like Patti Page or whatever it was, and then that would turn me on to 16 other things, and I would start learning all those other classic stuff and taught myself to play piano. The punk music there really, at his upholstery shop, really opened my eyes up to a whole new thing. And then a few years after that, I just sort of discovered Son House and Robert Johnson and the real early blues guys, and that was like layer three for me, and then that was on my own, so...
So, you were talking about things you came in contact with, music influences. In recent years, not as much as, let's say, 40, 50 years ago. Early on, rockers like Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, there was this pull of the church, you know, a call to throw off worldly desires, and they've had to deal with that on and off over the course of their careers. Now, I was reading somewhere, well, I know you were like an altar boy, but were you actually accepted to the seminary when you were young?
Yeah, I had plans to go to this seminary in Wisconsin, and I got accepted when I was 14. But then, I was sort of getting torn between two worlds, because I had just gotten this new amplifier and guitar, and I was told that I wouldn't be able to bring it with me. And I'd just done 8 years of Catholic school at that point, too. And I thought, wow, I don't know, maybe this is too early. I'm too young to make this decision to sort of jump into that world for a few years. And I thought, I also got accepted at this public school in Detroit. So I thought, maybe I should go to public school for a minute and then still, maybe I could still play music at home. So that kind of won over, I guess. It wasn't a gigantic struggle in my head, but I did have thoughts. If I went to the seminary, maybe I'll end up being a priest, because it feels like I have a little bit of some kind of, I don't know what it is. You kind of get this kind of calling of either up on a podium or up on a soapbox or something like that. I mean, people used to tell me when I was younger, you're a natural leader, Jack, and things like that. And I'm like, I don't feel that way, but maybe there's something else I don't know about myself that I'll figure out when I get older. I think you can't push that stuff down too long. You end up going on stage or something like that. Not because to be like a ham or be like to get everyone's attention. I think it's because what I have, for example, I don't have any nervousness when I walk onto stage. It doesn't give me any anxiety. It just feels like I'm in my living room by myself. So that, I think something like that is like, you know, that leads you to be able to be someone who can easily go up and try things out. Like, it doesn't mean you're talented. It doesn't mean you're, you know, going to be doing anything interesting, but it at least gets you half the way there, I guess.
Has the Lord called out to you since?
Not really. I like to just sort of learn about everything I can. You know, I go to different services at some times. I'll go to like Baha'i Faith this week or a Jewish synagogue next week. And if I'm on tour, I'll pop into different places. But, you know, religion to me is more like a creation of man or something. You know, I'm really more just interested in some kind of enlightenment, but try to figure something out, you know, Buddhism or Hinduism, whatever it is. It doesn't matter what the route is for me. I respect all of it now.
Yeah, no, this just popped in my head. I remember when you were getting married, it was reported that you guys were somewhere on the Amazon, or a shaman had conducted the service.
We were married by a shaman in the, on the Amazon River, and then but it was funnier even then that it wasn't legal in America. So I had to, we actually got married and tried to get married on the steps of the Ryman, and this guy came up and married us. We just saw his name in the phone book, and we were going to get married, and we were signing the marriage certificate on the hood of his Cadillac. And then someone came out of the room and said, "Hey, you guys want to get married on stage?" And we said, "Yeah." So we came in and got married on the stage of the Ryman Auditorium, the Grand Ole Opry. Mike was there and everything. And when we were about to finish, the lady came up and said, "Oh, you guys have to go because George Jones and Dolly Parton are coming in here now to film a video."
Oh, wow. Well, that's that's pretty perfect, though, really.
Funny name, too. I wish I could remember his name, but he was like, "I'll marry anybody anywhere for $100. You know, so it was funny.
You mentioned your apprenticing in an upholstery shop, and then later on you had the shop going yourself. I think, was it Third Man Upholstery?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so you had that happening. What's the timeline here between that shop and then when you joined, like, Goober and the Peas?
I had an apprentice when I was about 15, so that's like 1990. Then I'm all through high school learning, and then I get out of high school, what's that, 93? And then I joined Goober and the Peas. I was only in the band for about 6 months or something like that.
Oh.
Been like 93, 94. I was their 13th drummer that they had.
What was that? Oh, they grinded the drummers out, man. That's terrible.
I don't know. It was kind of like the Spinal Tap joke, but I learned so much on that too. I was 19 and we toured all over the country, and I learned so much about what to do, what not to do, about show business, about, you know, preparation, about all kinds of things. And, you know, I didn't even know how to drive. I remember trying to drive in New York and Chicago in the heavy traffic. I was so scared to drive this giant motorhome we would tour in.
All right, so you guys were in an RV?
Yeah, we went everywhere. I can remember. We definitely were down. I remember playing the 40 Watt and just up by Southwest and all that stuff, man. I can't remember where we didn't go. I don't think we went to Canada, but it was just America.
So most bands that I know that toured in RVs, they were just breaking down all the time. Did you guys have good luck in the RV?
No, it was a mess. It was worse than the White Stripes. The motorhome was better than the vans we had in the White Stripes. But yeah, it's rough, man. It's so funny to now be, you know, to own a record label, Third Man Records, and have artists on there now, and still see that these same things are still going on for these young artists. They'll be like, you know, the promoter, local promoter, trying to rip off a band, or trying not to pay for something, or trying not to pay for their dinner and stuff. And you think, man, this stuff was happening. This has always happened, and it's always going to happen, you know? Hilarious.
You and Meg, you formed the White Stripes, and I was wondering about the initial songs that you were writing with her. Was that material that you had been building up, or was the initial songs, or did you have notebooks of things you wanted to write about, or had already ideas? Or
Brian Muldoon, who I played, I worked at his upholstery shop, we had a band together called Two Part Resin, and eventually that we released a single under the name The Upholsterers. But that was he didn't have time to do that anymore, and he was too busy to play anymore. So he sort of encouraged me, like, you should go play with some other people. And I was looking around at the time, different people I knew, and, you know, I didn't have that many friends either. So but Meg and I started playing under the song David Bowie's Moon Age Daydream was the first thing we tried to learn together, and we just did it in a really simple way because she had never played the drums before. So it was very punk, sort of in the vibe of maybe something like the Gories, and it felt good. And then I had a song I wrote called Screwdriver, and it was sort of just kind of a, you know, just a soulful kind of thing, just kind of grooving. It was a real easy, like, kick drum and hi-hat, a thing she could do. And that ended up being on our first record. It ended up being a song we played live. It was a song we looked forward to playing live. And so it started off very immediately, sounded like something very unique. But again, we thought something that only we would like, or maybe people in the garage rock scene would like in Detroit. But it had more appeal than we realized, I guess.
You know, my favorite post-White Stripes band of yours is the Rock on Tours. You're in there with Brendan Benson and Jack Lawrence and Patrick Keeler, the latter two, from the Greenhorns. So the third album, Help a Stranger, came out last year, but there's like 11 years between that and Consolers of the Lonely. We're going to have to wait another 11 years?
I hope not, but it was a lot of work for sure. It's a tough moment in time right now. I think rock and roll is a little bit of a dip in pop culture, but I think those things have happened like many times in over the decades. You know, it's either guitars or synthesizers. In a way, it just goes up and down. And what tastes are like at any given time. People have pronounced rock and roll dead many times over the years, and I don't even think half the stuff I do is I could even call rock and roll. But I know that band, for example, that last year we did I would think is a rock and roll record. Almost the most rebellious thing you could do at this moment in time, you know, to record a rock and roll record onto tape, you know, in a funny way. But yeah, I love working with those guys. They're my friends. I mean, and you know, we used to, the rhythm section, Lil Jack and Patrick from the Greenhorns. I mean, we've all played shows with you and your band, the Woggles, I mean, you know, back in the day. And I think everyone was, I really loved that white soul sort of blue-eyed soul or whatever you call it, kind of vibe that your bands were putting out there. And that was something we fed off of too early on. I still do.
Well, thanks. If I could grow my hair like Wayne Cochran, I would. But so speaking about that kind of, so 2 or 3 years ago, we played a show in Detroit and we stayed with Amy Sardou, and she lives maybe a block away from the place there in Detroit, the Third Man Records cash corridor, and we went there to check it out. And they're at the store, way cool, all kinds of neat stuff in there. And then I walked to the back and I looked into the pressing plant, and while I'm standing there, there's very nice young man, a young fellow comes over, tallish fellow, and he asked me if I had any questions. And I was looking, you know, through the plate glass window, and I see the workers inside going about their tasks. And I asked him, "Where did you get the Oompa Loompas from?" And he kind of chuckled, but he said he wasn't sure. So, Jack, now that I got you here, where did you get the Oompa Loompas from? And can I have one too?
If I find a man, I'll send you one. You know what's great about that pressing plant is, and I think that's tough for a lot of other pressing plants around the world, is you're sort of grandfathered into these things, but we built our own pressing plant from scratch, and it's using all brand new machines, not antiquated ones. And because we started from scratch, we got to sort of just only be able to hire people who love music and love vinyl records, instead of, you know, having to be desperate and, you know, have to hire anybody who will take the job or something like that. It's been nice in the sense of, like, you know, it's a real family and community, people who really love music, and that's a special thing to be able to create it and have it going. We just got 4 new automated presses this last month and just doubled and tripled our output over the last year. So it's pretty amazing what's happening there.
So you're aware that Rainbow Records, a Rainbow pressing plant in LA, has been here for millions of years, but they're having to shut down because the landlord there raised the rent. And
That's sad. They pressed the first White Stripes records, really.
So do you press only Third Man releases, or the your plant open to taking in other outside orders?
Open to taking all kinds of orders. We do gigantic reissues, you know, for Universal, Warner Brothers. We do punk bedroom label 45s in small batches. We do all the Third Man catalog that we can, our subscription service. We just try to do everything we possibly can for anybody, but it's definitely there for other people to use first and foremost, and then when we have time, we'll get to our own stuff.
Well, man, I was wondering too, you know, we've talked about rock and roll sort of in a dip. These things are all cyclical, I agree, but the record business is such a hard one, even with this talked about vinyl comeback, making and selling records really tough thing. Why did you start that?
Well, the funny thing is, you know, when we had come out of in 2009 when we opened Third Man Records, it was all just baby steps. I thought, I got my vinyl rights back. Virgin Records had gone out of business, and all the White Stripes vinyl had come back to me, the ownership of it. So I thought, well, if I could hire a couple of guys to maybe re-release all of our old 45s, just so they'd be available. I don't like when things are out of print. It seems kind of unromantic, sad thing. So Ben Blackwell and Ben Swank from the Soul Dead Brothers and Dirt Bombs, respectively, backwards. They were interested in moving to Nashville and taking on the idea. So it was just going to be a place I stored my equipment and then re-release these 45s and LPs of my own style. And then the venue in the back, we turned it into a rehearsal place. And then I said, well, we could actually have live shows here. Bands could play here if they want to. Then it was also a film studio, and I built a dark room in the back. I said, why don't we build a little shop in front? People could maybe ring the bell once a week, and someone could come in, and maybe collectors or something come in and buy records. Maybe that turned into, we got to hire a full staff at the store because everyone's ringing their doorbell 5 minutes. And just baby steps on and on. It just turned into this gigantic institution, empire. Now we have a location in Detroit with the pressing plant. Right. And there's so many things about that we just think, I just want to put things in these buildings that I always wanted to see when I went on tour. Like, I wanted to see a old vintage recording booth where you could make your own records somewhere on tour. And I wanted to find a, you know, this kind of thing there, old Scopatone machine or something like that. But also to be booting out things immediately right now and mixing the two together, digital and streaming and everything that's happening right now is, you know, first and foremost when we talk about it, what we're releasing. So it's a mixture of all the what's good about new and what's good about the old.
Well, I liked what you said there about records going out of print and that being just a very, very sad thing. One thing I like about Third Man is that you have reissued stuff like Sun Record 45s and Motown things. So you got there was no problem getting the licensing for that stuff?
They were very happy. I think that the Sun Records were very happy to someone to take on the 45 production, because they're mostly interested in the digital and licensing the movies and things like that, and that's how they kind of make their money, I think.
Right.
And then a lot of these estates, it's the best thing is when we can release a blues record or an old rock and roll record and figure out a way to actually pay the artist for it. You know, that's what's not as easy as everyone thinks it is. You know, our intentions are always to try to how are we going to pay this person's estate or this person's grandkids or whoever if they're not alive anymore? You know, sometimes it's not possible. People have sold the rights to their music, or some label somewhere owns it, or a lot of times nobody knows who owns it. You know, a lot of these garage rock labels that we came up with, me and you, Manfred, you know, that we all love, they pressed and released records that, for all intents and purposes, were bootlegs, because no one really knows who owns the rights to a lot of that stuff. And there's not that much money in them because they're so obscure. So you try to find that balance of, you know, we want these things to exist. I want to be able to get that such and such record. I want to get, that record. I want that record to be made available. A teenager should be able to come into this store and be able to get something from Motown or Chess Records if they're interested. And also, whatever new punk band that's happening right now or singer that's happening right now, a country artist, let's try to do both. So that's where our heads are at. Yeah, but you get into these long things where you're trying to really do the best thing for the artist. Yeah, I think we do with that. We released Captain Beefheart's Child Mask replica, and we made a concession to figure out how to pay the band members who are still alive, even though we don't have any legal reason to do that. They don't have any legal right to it, except that we want them to get a taste of that. And it's a nice thing to be able to be a part of when you can.
Well, so we've talked about some of the reissue stuff you've done. I know you've got Third Man Records. You've got a lot of artists on the label. But tell me about the newest thing out that you'd like to plug and let people know about.
Well, you know, on your show, I'm sure Olivia Jean's new album, Night Owl, is just amazing. I think she's a great surf guitar player. She produced the album herself, plays a lot of the instruments herself. Just very cool. I love to see, you know, female musicians and songwriters, especially guitar players out there and could do what she's doing. So I think that fits in really well with the underground garage world. And we also have, you know, we put out Margo Price's last two albums. She's an amazing country star. Lily Mae, she made this brilliant, dark, and sort of moody country album with Dave Cobb last year. And that's just beautiful. Like, it's highly underrated in the Nashville scene. How it should be considered. I think it's probably the most important country record that came out in the last year, but it's very under the radar. And then, you know, we're releasing some Screaming Jay Hawkins records, re-releases coming out. We got the Supremes box set that we put out recently, a Patsy Cline collection that we licensed. And as you said before, like, you know, all the Sun and Chess records we have in there too. But yeah, man, it's just something happening every week at Third Man. I can't even keep up. I could talk about it for an hour. We already did too. We just released the second issue of our new magazine. We put out a magazine now called Maggot Brain, through Third Man Records and Third Man Books. We have a publishing company, and this is something I think is the people who really love music, which I know that's the people who listen to your station, that they'll really dig. You know, it's sort of almost like the way we used to read Mojo magazine back in the 90s, right, and recently even to today. But it's the people who really love music want to dig deeper. These are interesting things.
Well, just before we started talking, I played Over and Over and Over off your solo album, the 2018 full-length Boarding House Reach. And my understanding is that that's a song that actually dates back to your White Stripe days. You didn't record it then. Maybe it would have wound up as a Rock on Tours thing. Something about, at some point, you're going to do something with Jay-Z with it. What is this song's story, and why the long birth canal for it?
It's so bizarre. It's so aptly titled over and over and over. It's very hilarious because I've actually been talking to Ben Blackwell, a third man, about releasing an album of all the versions of this song over the years. I don't know if anyone would be interested in that, but it might be funny to see the progression of it. Yeah, it was started off as a riff that I had. Damn, I want to say maybe it's either Get Behind Me, Satan or Icky Thump. I can't remember what White Stripes record where I started playing this riff, and I did a demo of it with Meg. And then that didn't work out. And then the Raconteurs, I think Consoler's album, we tried it. It didn't work out. Then my first solo album, Blunderbuss, I tried it. It didn't work out. Then I tried it with the Dead Weather. It didn't work out. Then I tried it with Jay-Z. We had a song going called Ray-Bans. And he rapped over it. And I heard one verse of him rapping over it. And I recorded all the music at this moment in New York. Uh-huh. And then I never heard it again. I never got a copy of it from him. So I've never heard that version of me and Jay-Z, actually. But we did several tracks, me and him. We did, like, I don't know what it was. Like, I think we were working on 7 or 9 tracks for an album of me and his together. Just didn't get finished. But then I did it again for another project and it didn't work out. So finally, I don't know what it was. It was this Bumble Buzz pedal that we sell at Third Man. It's mm-hmm. really low octave fuzz thing. And I hit that one day and it just like, oh, that was the tone. That's the tone. And for some reason it just kind of came together. The right musicians were in the room and the right vibe was there and it just felt good to me. I don't really know if it's the best version or if it was right. It was just one of those things where at that time it felt right, and all the other times it did. So, yeah, maybe it would be funny to put out a LP of all those versions.
Well, maxi single.
Yeah, exactly.
A 33 and a third 12-inch, you could do that.
Exactly,
like a dance thing. So last year's Rock on Tour album, year before the solo album, what's down the pike here in 2020 for you with your own music?
I have no musical plans. I try never to plan ahead if I can on anything that I work on. So right now I have absolutely nothing, no shows booked and no studio ideas and no songs written. So But you could talk to me next week and it could be, I just wrote 6 songs this week. It just came out of me and now I'm going to try to work on some.
Jack, I'll check in with you next week about that then.
But, please do, yes.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up here in a moment. The song I want to go out with is a White Stripes tune. We're going to be friends. It's off White Blood Cells. You mentioned Susie Lee in there, but I was wondering, was there any one friend that inspired that?
I can't remember. I was dating a girl at that time. I remember writing that on her bed. And she had gone to work, and I had written that sitting on her bed one day in Detroit. I can't remember. I can't remember what was going through my head there. It must have been. There was a little bit of a thought of. I think I saw the interview with Paul McCartney talking about that. He wrote Yellow Submarine as he was about to fall asleep. And he said something about, you know, at those moments right, where these silly thoughts go through your head right before you go to sleep. And then that there's a line in the song, We're Gonna Be Friends, about silly thoughts go through my head. That was definitely from that Paul McCartney interview about Yellow Submarine. But I don't know what the rest of it was all about.
Yeah, have you ever sung that song as a lullaby to your children?
Oh, yeah, for sure. They love it. You know, it's kind of one of those songs, you know, you just rewrite all the, as the years go on, you write and you write and you write for different things, or they just come out of you. And once in a while, something just kind of comes out of you that makes sense to other people. And that was one of those songs, I guess, because you know, I was listening the other day to Neil Sedaka on XM radio talking about his songs and where his ideas were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of songwriters get these inspirations. Like, I wanted to write a song like blank. I listened to this other song, and I wanted to write something like that. It inspired me. I guess I don't really have that in me. I don't have that. I want to write something like blah blah blah. I it just comes out of me, and then people might say, oh, you know, that sounds like Devo, or that sounds like Neil Young, or something. Later on, I'm like, yeah, maybe so. I guess, but I'm not going to stop it. Whatever it is, it's just, you guys got to let it come out, see what happens. Fly it up the flagpole, see if anyone salutes. I always say.
Well, I salute that every time. So there's this really cool Skid Roper tune, Lincoln Logs. Are you familiar with that?
No, I don't know that one.
It's another great sort of, he's like, so he's talking to his mother. He's singing, you know, what happened to my Lincoln Logs, or where did they go? And that, and also that Tom Waits, I Don't Want to Grow Up, are both these tunes where they're, you know, they're definitely adults wishing back to these childhood days. And what I love about We're Going to Be Friends, it's just, at least to me, as I'm listening to it, it's really well put into the perspective of a kid, you know, having these experiences. And
reminded me, I think there was a little bit of vibe going on from the Big Star song 13.
Okay.
At that time, and that was a song written as if the singer was 13 years old, and I always loved that one, and that might have been kind of floating around in my head at that time too. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. I love all those songs, and I think it's like, you know, John Peel, you know, the great DJ, his favorite song was Teenage Kicks by the Undertones, right. And that song starts off with Teenage Dreams So Hard to Beat, and he has that on his that's on his tombstone. Teenage Dreams So Hard to Beat. And it really is, man. No matter how old we get, you have to tap into that freshness of youth, where you have everything ahead of you, and everything's mysterious still. You know, you don't have any experience. You have passion, but you don't have any experience. And yeah, that's nice when these kind of songs can tap into that.
So one last thing about this. Now, you mentioned doing publishing with Third Man and having the magazine. That this song was made into a children's book, and was that? Did you guys do the publishing on that?
We did. That came out on Third Man Books, and that it's actually our biggest seller. It's a lot to do with April March, the very, very cool Eleanor Blake, who goes under the stage name April March, and a lot of people know her song Chick Habit. I'm sure you've played it on your show.
Yeah.
She did the illustrations on that book, and I had wanted to do something with her for years. She had made a drawing for me a long time ago, back when we were both on the Sympathy for the Record Industry label, back in the early Garage Rock days, and she sent me a drawing in the mail, and I had framed it. And so she'd worked on Ren and Stimpy and Pee Wee's Playhouse, and she's an amazing illustrator, an amazing singer, and all this stuff. So yeah, the idea came up about her illustrating that song. I think it was Chet Weiss at Third Man Books maybe had generated the idea, and yeah, she just did a great job. It was just beautiful.
Jack, thanks so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
You, man. Great to talk to you, too. Really, really, you know, you're one of my favorite frontmen from our scene that we came up in, and, you know, you always got me moving, so thanks for doing that. Appreciate that, and thanks for all the great songs you play on your show. I listen to it almost every day.
Oh, man, thanks. Well, here's We're Going to Be Friends from the White Stripes in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell. Brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Walk with me, Susie Lee, through the park and by the tree. We will rest upon the ground and look at all the bugs we found. Safely walk to school without a sound. Safely walk to school without a sound.
We're going to be friends. That's the White Stripes off of 2001's White Blood Cells here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Jack White for joining me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. And catch me next week when we'll check in with the Dolly Rots. They've got a new single out now on Wicked Cool Records called Make Me Hot. And I'll chat with their guitar player, Luis Cabezas, all about it. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.